I think I'm on recording all this too. So we continue with the Psalms of Ascent, Psalm 123. The psalmist is being humiliated, it becomes clear. He's in exile, that also becomes clear. Suggestions that some of the scholars come up with. Is he living under Samaritan governor at the time of the reconstruction of Judah by Nehemiah? So is he about the middle of the 5th century when it wasn't an independent, it was a satrapy of the Persian, vast Persian Empire, and the governor was actually from Samaria? So is that the feeling of it? Or does he belong to a social class in Judah that's being humiliated by others of their own people? Being put down for some reason? So you can't. The evidence doesn't answer these questions, but I'm just playing with possibilities. So let's have a look at the psalm. I lift up my eyes to you who are enthroned in the heavens. It's inevitable, we human beings, with our structures, we always think of God as being up, don't we? And go up onto the mountain, and God of the head. I mean, Zeus was the God of the... So it's just a normal thing to do. It's a bit stupid, really, because spatial images don't do anything, but we've got to be human, so that's how we do it. They're doing it too. The psalmist looks to God knowing that his real value is in relationship to God and that God will never humiliate. That's a nice thought, by the way, put in there. God will never humiliate anyone. Well, you know that from Jesus. So here's Psalm 131, which we'll do in a couple of weeks' time. In fact, we'll do it next week. Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high. I don't occupy myself with things too great or too marvelous for me, but I've calmed and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. My soul is like the weaned child that is with me. It's a little two-year-old who's run up to mum, and you see this in the church all the time. I do anyhow. I'm dressed in these enormous garments, and you say hello to a little child, and he runs in and hides. Very wise child. Hides behind mum's knees or something. Some of them aren't. You know, it depends on their temperament, doesn't it? But it's a protective place to go. Well, this is happening here too. The author is not liking God to a mother in this. Yeah, when my brother John died, we used to read this a lot, this psalm, his favourite psalm. But it's like your feelings, just as a mother or father quietens down, calms down a little weaned child, a little two-year-old running around, so the author is doing the same to his own feelings. That's the point. He's getting all... It's really quite a modern psalm in a way. He's all disturbed inside, but he's talking to himself and he's calming down his feelings the way you calm a little child. And he's calming the feelings by remembering that even though people are hurting him or whatever, God will never do it, and God is with him, and I am with you always. And it's the memory of God that is getting him to take a deep breath and calm down. God's heart goes out to the humiliated. Psalm 113, we did recently. Who is like Yahweh our God, who is seated on high, who looks far down on the heavens and the earth? He raises the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes, with the princes of his people. He gives the barren woman a home, making her the joyous mother of children. Praise Yahweh. Obviously has to be read symbolically, because there's many beautiful women who love a child and can't have one, and their prayer doesn't seem to be answered. Not the way they expect anyhow, but maybe they can go and become a mother to orphans in Mexico, you know what I mean? Maybe they can go and a lot of other things happen if our mind is lateral a bit. Look at the wonderful women religious who've gone into religious order and I don't know how they do it, to be quite honest, but many thousands did and gave up. I mean, as a male you feel a bit different, but for women to give up being a mother, you know, and give up being a lover and all that, must be, I don't know, it seems to me harder than for a bloke, but maybe it's not. But look at all the thousands that did it and became mothers to so many beautiful children. You probably know you were taught by teachers yourself who gave up motherhood but got a motherhood that was 100 times fold. Your sister is a good example, Mari. So, Psalm 25. We've got one here too, who's giving it a go, aren't you? Good on you. My eyes are ever towards Yahweh, for he will pluck my feet out of the net. Turn to me, be gracious to me, I'm lonely and afflicted. Relieve the troubles of my heart and bring me out of my distress. Consider my affliction and my trouble and forgive all my sins. So if you've forgotten we did Psalm 25, you might want to go back and read it. It's not too bad, is it? And Psalm 69, my eyes grow dim with waiting for my God, praying, but nothing's happening, just waiting. Looking like the father of the prodigal son, looking into the distance too and thinking his son had never come home. And one day he did. Psalm 119, my eyes fail with watching for your promise. I ask, when will you comfort me? And Psalm 141, my eyes are turned towards you, Yahweh, my Lord. In you I seek refuge. Don't leave me defenseless. Which reminds me of Jesus just after he says not to scandalize. He talks about if you're going to become, you have to follow him, you have to be like a little child. So he's not talking about little children here particularly, he's just talking about any of us. You have to be like a little child if you want to follow Jesus. But if you become like a little child, you become very vulnerable. You become very trusting. You become very, you refuse not to love, you know. So that makes you pretty vulnerable, doesn't it? You can't get back at people, or you can't use power to put people. So you're a very vulnerable person, you're a little child. Well then Jesus goes straight on then and talks about the dreadful thing that is scandal, to take advantage of someone who's trusting and loving for your own advantage. That's what scandal is. It's just a dreadful thing to do. So don't leave me defenseless is the prayer. So let's go on with our psalm now. So that was verse 1, which was, I lift up my eyes to you who are enthroned in the heavens. And verse 2, as the aisle of male slaves wait for the gesture of their master, as the eyes of female slaves wait for the gesture of their mistress, so our eyes look to Yahweh our God as we wait for signs of his tender compassion towards us. So that takes us to the incarnation scene, doesn't it? Where Mary uses that same word, but in Greek, of course, in the New Testament. The handmaid of the Lord, let it be done to me as you have said. So eyes, I mean, it would be a wonderful way to live. All you want to do, Teresa of Avila, want only what God wants. So if that's true, that you really only want what God wants, then you'll be listening, watching, discerning, not anxiously. Anxiety and God don't mix very well at all. It's trustingly. So you're waiting and you want to do what God wants, and you do something you've worked didn't work out, but you just keep going, you know, whatever, back off or keep going. But that's, as long as you really want it, that's what he wants to do. Just like watching for the nearest gesture and then off you go. Psalm 116 echoes a bit of that. I called on the name of Yahweh. Yahweh, I pray, save my life. Gracious is Yahweh and righteous. Our God is tenderly compassionate. Yahweh protects the simple. When I was brought low, he saved me. And our psalm continues, and I've got the Greek translation here from the Septuagint, just to show you. The Hebrew is, have mercy on us. Really, it's be gracious to us, Hanan. Yahweh, have mercy on us. But the Greek is interesting. Kyrie eleison, Kyrie eleison. Where do you think we got it from? So in the New Testament, when they're writing their lovely icons, writing an icon doesn't, you know what I mean? The Gospels are really iconic. They're not actual factual statements, for heaven's sake. They're written with poetry and love and all that. They're based on fact, but they're not stupid like we can be. They're playing with the whole business. Well, when they have the two blind men in Matthew who are at the city, you know, of Jericho, and they're blind, of course, and they ask to what they cry out in that scene in Matthew, in the plural, Mark's got in the singular, so it's a bit different, is Kyrie eleison. Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy, which picks up this psalm and which then goes on into the church's liturgy and becomes our Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy, etc. So it's all linked in, And they're asking Yahweh, Kyrie, the Lord in Greek, to have mercy, eleison. Verse 4. I've had more than I can take of the scorn of the arrogant, the contempt of the proud. He's up to here with it. He's sick of it. It's driving him mad. He can't take any more. I've had more than I can take of the scorn of the arrogant and the contempt of the proud. We might think of Jesus' word, the Son of Man is to go through many sufferings and be treated with contempt. I don't imagine Jesus, you know, well, maybe I'm wrong here, but I don't imagine him minding being treated with contempt so much for himself, but thinking of the people who are doing it, you know. If they're treating Jesus with contempt, his heart was a bit like being a parent. I imagine when your kid is hurting you, I imagine your main hurt is for the child, isn't it? I mean, you realise that the child in hurting you is hurting themselves dreadfully and you can't do anything about it, maybe. So, anyway, so we contemplate Jesus being mocked by the soldiers, those passing by, the leaders, those being crucified with him. They're all mocking him. Here's a text. That's all Mark there, but listen to Luke. The people stood by watching, but the leaders scoffed at him. He saved others, let him save himself if he's the Messiah of God, his chosen one. Let him save himself. And Jesus had been saying all his life, you can't save yourself. You have to give yourself and you'll be saved. If you try and save yourself, that's what he says, doesn't he? You lose it. If you try and save it, you lose it. You've got to lose it. You've got to give it away. You've got to get it. And all you mums and dads and teachers and aunties and uncles know that. I know a bit of it myself as a priest too. So if you just give yourself to others and then something is possible, it might flow back. It mightn't, but if it does, it's always a grace. So you can't save yourself. So they haven't got the foggiest understanding of what they're saying. The soldiers mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine. We recall Jesus' words picked up later by Peter. And Jesus' words are, blessed are you. When people revile you and persecute you, utter all kinds of evil against you falsely because of me. It's a dangerous text because there are people, you know them, I mean personally, but there are groups of people who identify with being a martyr. So without charity, without love, they can take a stand of criticism of the church or the bishop or the pope or anybody, people of a certain sexual inclination or people who are finding love in a second relationship at last, having been through a torment in a first one, or whatever the situation might be, and people can be critical of them, and then you have to be critical of such people. But when you are critical of them, they see that as they're just being persecuted because they're standing for Jesus and standing for the truth and standing for orthodoxy. Do you get what I'm trying to get at? It becomes like a self-identity thing. And really what they're doing is they're lacking love, basically. And the insecurity is what they're defending. And they'll always back themselves up with the Pope or with the Church or with orthodoxy. And then you get to know them a bit and you realise, no, they're just digging a little wall, or building a wall around their own wounded psyche, and I don't blame them for that. But that they lash out at others in doing this is reprehensible and has to be named. And when you name it, because you have to, you can't put up with that kind of behaviour, and you shouldn't, they become quite vicious. And then they think that they're actually martyrs for the truth. Am I going too far, or are you with me? But it's dangerous stuff, because, and you must name it, by the way. You can't put, I mean, I think that's right. In my present job, I'd be happy to be advised otherwise, but I would always do that, I think. I mean, I do it when I see it. If someone behaves in a way that's hurtful of another person, then you have to name it and say it. You can't, because that doesn't help anybody to pretend or to just, you've got to be gentle and kind, I know. But gentle and kind does not mean avoiding, does it? I think the person has to be approached and said, no, you know, that was what you said was hurtful. It's quite unacceptable. And I think if you don't, well, you're going to advise me on this. I just think if you don't do that, things keep festering and keep going on. And in ordinary family life, you do it. So in the church, we should do it too, I think. And I think I haven't been good at it in the past, because I've always tried to be nice and kind, but I think I'm learning you're not nice and kind if you're not truthful. So I have to, and I don't find it that difficult, I don't think. But in religious life and in priestly life and in church life, there is a real danger that we can think being kind is what Jesus was, to the extent that we don't face the truth. The truth is the victim of gentle, kind, loving. That's beautiful, that's beautiful. You say beautiful to that person, you say beautiful to that person, they're in contradiction, they both think you agree with them, and the whole dash thing gets out of order. So this persecution business has got to be... And the litmus test is as simple as simple. If a person comes up to me and is critical of me and they're loving, I will listen. So will you. You listen. If people come up and they're critical but they're not humble and they're not gentle and they don't care, you can't listen and you shouldn't listen. You've got to defend yourself. So the key is love. It's as simple as that, really. By their fruits you'll know. Peter, 1 Peter, picks up Jesus' story there. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory, which is the Spirit of God, is resting on you. It's beautiful, really, when it's real. Lovely phrase, isn't it? The Spirit of God is resting on you. But that was used, oh dear, tell me if I'm going too far today, but that was just, you know, in generations earlier, to keep marriages together, which were destructive and, you know, abusive, wasn't it? You know, people would kind of, Spirit of God's with you, it's all right, you're promised for better or worse, so you kind of stay there, and it's untruthful, and your life's being destroyed by somebody who doesn't... You can't do that. I mean, you have to... I don't know what you've got to do, but you can't do that. You've got to be truthful. You go through hard times, don't you? But I keep remembering, crosses aren't bad, necessarily, but most of them are bad. And look at the Calvary. There's three crosses there, but only one saved us, if you know what I mean. So there are many crosses in life that we shouldn't be wearing. And we're not helping the other people involved by wearing them. We should name it or get help to do it. The truth matters, is what I'm saying, I think. The psalmist encourages us to reflect on the folly of being self-satisfied and looking down on others. And we might think of that. You'd nearly laugh at it, except that it's so real. You've got that Pharisee up the front saying, oh, you've got the ordinary people, the bulk of people in the church, in the synagogue. They're okay. And there's one bloke who separates himself out from them. Oh, he's not going to be in that mob. He's up the front. Oh, don't you laugh now. Just because the priests are always up the front. So he's up the front, this Pharisee bloke, saying, God, I'm not like the rest of this lot. And it's very well written by Luke. It says, he said to himself, O Lord of heaven and earth, blah, blah, blah. But he's looking in a mirror And God is his projection, of, you know what I mean. So he says, I'm not like them, blah, 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 and he goes on. And there's another bloke who's separated himself from the group too. He's right down there in the corner pew. And up till a few weeks ago, he could have perhaps stayed there, but we've now got a system where everyone runs around the church greeting everybody. So the poor bloke wouldn't have much chance here now, because someone would go and grab him and find out who he is. And anyhow, he's down there in the back, and he just doesn't feel worthy of joining you, because you're all so good. And look at them, and their marriages are really perfect, and mine's in a mess. And they're really lovely. They're just such lovely people. And look at them, and they do, you know how people think, we think? Everyone's better at us than everything we do. And they're up, you know, they look so good. Oh, for God's sake. So down that back, this poor bloke is saying, I'm not worthy because I'm a sinner. So the one out in his own, another out in his own. And where does Jesus end up going? He'd like to help this bloke. He tried. He said, woe upon you, you know, like 100 times. What are you doing this for? But if the bloke's not listening, you can't do anything. He's got to go. So he goes down the back, puts his arm around the bloke down the back and says, it's okay. You look, you don't worry about that lot. You know, and invites him. He said he goes home justified, this bloke doesn't. Not because God's holding it against him, but because he won't receive justification, he won't open his arms to it. So it's a dreadful place to be. Here's Paul, very good line, by the grace of God I am what I am. So Paul says, oh God, I don't know what to do with all this. We think Paul's terrific. Paul thought he wasn't so good at all. I reckon he was terrific. Such a good, intelligent writer. Whoever belittles another lacks sense, says the book of Proverbs. An intelligent person, oh dear. Well, it's, yeah. I don't think I can read on this verse. Remains silent. Proverbs, those who mock the poor insult their maker. Those who are glad at calamity will not go unpunished. Proverbs again, those who despise their neighbours are sinners, but happy are those who are kind to the poor. Sirach, don't cheat the poor of their living. This is quite relevant, I think, in today's political world. Read it carefully. Don't cheat the poor of their living. Don't keep needy eyes waiting. Don't grieve the hungry or anger one in need. Don't add to the troubles of the desperate or delay giving to the needy. Don't reject a suppliant in distress or turn your face away from the poor. Don't avert your eye from the needy and give no one reason to curse you. For if in bitterness of soul some should curse you, the Creator will hear their prayer. I don't think he got that right, but you get the general feel of what he's saying, don't you? And Sirach again, the wisdom of the humble lifts their head high and seats them among the great. Don't, and you think of those lovely, wise old people that have influenced you in your life. Really simple, beautiful, wise people. Well, that's what he's talking about. And they're humble. They're always humble. Don't praise individuals for their good looks or loathe anyone because of appearance alone. Don't boast about wearing fine clothes. Don't exalt yourself when you're honoured. Pretty good advice from an old Jewish leader.